Listener Production. There are places in the human experience where ordinary language falls short, but where comedy can find a way in. Andy Lee, together with Hamish Blake, have become one of the greatest comedy duos in Australian history. Working closely with Andy, I have seen his beauty, kindness, and grace firsthand. Andy says, everything in life will work out if you stay positive and focus on the things that make you happy. What follows is a conversation about the struggles of being in the public eye, the dark days of his mum's illness, and how important it is to treat every person, no matter who they are, equally.
I don't like hierarchy.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm like against the man,
yeah.
Let's bring him down. It's more just, again, there's people in really powerful positions that I've met along the way that share the same values.
Mm.
And I'm respect them so much and the way they lead, and you take a lot from that. But anyone that's going to use their power as an extra means to get what they want, I have a visceral reaction to that. So I'm very comfortable treating them just the same as anyone else.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Working as a podcast and radio producer, I have been fortunate enough to cross paths with many intriguing people who have had a profound impact on me. In this series, I share stories and experiences from the people who have brought inspiration to my life, and hopefully yours too. Andy Lee is an entertainer and author of the children's series Do Not Open This Book. In this episode, you'll understand why I look at Andy as one of my greatest mentors for kindness and absolute professionalism. Andy, you grew up in Melbourne, Australia.
Yes.
And you're one of three.
Mm.
Growing up in the Lee family, what was that like? What was it like as a child?
It was great. Yeah, we all got along. Mum and Dad are both primary school teachers, so there was a point where Mum and Dad were teaching at the same schools all three of us are going to.
Really?
So we could all get in the family van. It was a high-ace camper van that you'd spend all our holidays in, and we'd all go together to school.
Oh, my God, that's unbelievable.
It was pretty, so, and then go home at the same time. So I think the advantage of having parents that were primary school teachers is certainly not money. You don't...
Yes, that's true. That is true.
Aren't getting paid probably what they deserve. But what it did do, though, was holidays. I mean, we had the exact holiday sync up for them. So whatever it is off, how many weeks off a year, you get to spend that time with your mum and dad the entire way through, and also after school. So as far as parents, they were around a lot, and we kind of benefited from that.
Being the middle child, how is that? You're very close to your brother and sister, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah, very close. Fine. I didn't get a chance to check out any other position, so I'm not sure how it compares. Very lucky in the sense to have an older brother, particularly an older sporty brother, and I was interested in sports. So you're constantly trying to keep up with him and play along with him and his friends, which I think in that environment makes you a better, you
know. Yes.
You're often at the bottom of the pack, so you have to try harder. So that was great. And then my younger sister as well, who I probably wasn't, we've kind of gone through areas of being close and not so close throughout our whole lives. But yeah, we're back really, really close, the three of us.
One thing that I've noticed, which I think is absolutely so beautiful, that you have so many of the friends that you had when you were growing up at school 20 years later, they're like the best friends that,
yep,
you know, a person could ever have. How did you kind of maintain those friendships? I think that's so beautiful.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, I don't know why this is, but it seems, and whether this is going to come across as really sexist, but it seems easier for males to do it than females,
yep,
it seems, in life.
Why do you think that is?
I think a couple of things. I think, you know, mateship is different than female mateship. I think it's evolving for females. And again, this is just my opinion, but when I talk to my female friends, it's harder to have a wider pack of 20 people.
Yeah.
Probably because you're smarter than females and they require... and so they don't require as many people to stimulate them. I think, look, sporting teams does that as well.
Yes, that's true.
And, I've got mates through that I met in kindergarten still that we still are still really close with, see kind of most weeks. And then there's a kind of eight from school that, yeah, I see most weeks. And I think people also get lucky in their friendship groups. Yeah, some yes. people have a good bunch of people at school and others don't, and others find that at university. But yeah, I was lucky that I found a great bunch of guys at school and that got along with everyone's families and et cetera. It was just easy. It was just easy.
During your adolescence, you had to go through something that was obviously quite sad. Your mum became quite ill.
Yeah.
Which was obviously very traumatic for your family. And take us through that. How did you cope with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something I talk about very often, but yeah, mum got sick, but she's also still with us, so really, really lucky. But she got given 2 weeks to live in 96.
Really?
And then again, they thought she was going to pass, I don't know, a couple of years later. It all becomes a bit blurry, but we kind of stopped believing doctors' opinions for a while there. I still love doctors. I love our medical industry. I think the hospital and healthcare system that Australia has is just incredible. Mm. And also the other organisations around to support. So it's not a knock on that. It was more just you didn't have to take what anyone was saying
on
face value because it was all really new. From what I can gather, Mum was the first to survive this disease. It was called cerebral vasculitis. So cerebral being the brain and vasculitis in your vein system, where essentially it's like having strokes, but strokes happen in the artery, normally stop your whole body. This was strokes in the veins, so little clots, and it shut off a lot of her brain, or part of her brain. So she figured out how to walk, talk, who we all were, and that was probably for about, I can't really recall, but I think she was in hospital for about 6 months, where she was just out of it. So,
and how old were you at the time?
I was 15. Yeah. So, it's a strange thing to have to go in each day and introduce yourself to your mum and say, I'm Andy, I play the trumpet, I like playing hockey, and have those Groundhog Day conversation. But as far as coping, I used to laugh a lot, which I know is weird, and I'd make jokes about it.
It's a beautiful coping mechanism.
My coping mechanism is generally making jokes about a situation, even if it's dark humour. Yeah. But, I don't know. I think that's probably why my family is super close now. Mm. If there's ever any silver lining for mum being sick, it's the fact that you really treasure not just her but the overall family dynamic and the relationship. So, we spend a lot of time together, all five of us, and now they're growing families around that. And but at the time, it was kind of muscle on. I used to pride myself more on being tough in these situations, but it's not really a great thing to pride yourself on.
No. I suppose when you're young, that's all you want to do. And especially, I suppose, as a male, you just want to be the tough one, probably for your sister as well and for your mum.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think I think as we certainly grow older and even more in today's day and age, you realise that's not particularly manly.
Not at all.
But certainly liked being a rock or being someone who could cope. And I was probably compartmentalising a lot of things or not addressing them, which, again, potentially isn't that healthy. But yeah, I mean, for me, it was, I think it was the time where I drifted from my sister, and if I had any regrets, it would have been the fact that she was becoming a woman, 13 years of age. Sometimes you need a female around at that point, and I was
for sure
scheduling and logistics everyone's life to make sure that everything was happening with mum not being around, which is not probably as understanding as I could have been.
But you're so organised, I know that. So that's probably your coping mechanism was to be that.
Or just stepping in and going, okay, well, I feel like someone might need to do this now, which was no doubt a help at the time, and we all talked about it, but probably shuts off an emotional support mechanism. And so, but my brother is brilliant in those areas. So that's why him and my sister became a bit closer.
Oh, that's brilliant. And how's your mum now?
Yeah, good. Still hanging around.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, I mean, it is. And then, look, they they just keep monitoring. There's more people, and if anyone has cerebral vasculitis listening to this, the very few times I've talked about it over the last 20 years, there has been a handful of people have reached out and scared and have survived, and my mum's so happy to chat to anyone about it.
She's a beautiful woman.
Because it's really shocking and hard to cope with that you have to restart all these things. But if mum's anything to go by, she can walk again, she can talk, she snapped out of it, she remembers. She doesn't remember a lot of that year.
Yeah.
The brain's strange in that way. But she's also got an amazing memory for things before that.
Wow.
Like encyclopedic, it's bizarre. She kind of knows. Well, say, oh, I remember when we would do it here, and she'll go, no, we're actually there and you're
isn't
wearing
that incredible?
This. And they've only just had tests recently where it showed that mum's the black spot in her brain that had kind of had lost all that connective tissue. There's new I don't know the official term for it, but it's relating and it's redirected things around it. So it's not necessarily healing that part,
yes.
But it's been managed to reroute certain signals, and so the brain is still kind of trying to work out how to deal with it for this many years later. So she's still her brain's still working on it. Well, I would have given up a while ago.
We've had her on the show a few times, and she's amazing. She's so funny as well.
She is. She's during that time we kind of felt like, and particularly the drugs you were taking. It was kind of like truth serum. So you found out what she thought of you, which was quite amusing because she's a very polite person and would never want to step anyone's toes. So I thought this was a great new side of mum. Yeah, she's great.
Then after school, you went on to go to university where you met the fabulous Hamish Blake.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of huge things to come. How did you guys meet?
It's strange, but I was in a management tute.
Management
yes.
tute? What were you studying?
I was studying commerce, commerce arts at Melbourne, and I hadn't been for the entire year, and I knew, actually it was quantitative methods this one, but I'd met this guy called Pete in a management tute. It was quantitative methods. I hadn't been the entire year. I knew I was going to fail. You got 1 percentage point per attendance day and there was 10 tutes. And so I went there and the tutor said, oh, Andrew Lee's not here again. And I said, no, I am here. And he said, well, you haven't been here the entire year. And I said, can I make a speech to the class as to why that was important that I wasn't here? And the tutor was kind of funny guy. He said, yeah, sure. So I got up in front of the class and I said, I would have distracted you all. I'm terrible in these type of situations. For the good of everyone in this class, in the hope that they win, that they pass, I decided not to come.
Hilarious.
And I think I deserve 10 marks out of 10 for attendance just because of this selflessness that I've shown. And the guy gave me 10.
Did he?
And I passed 51%. So I would have got 41.
That's amazing.
And I was walking out of that chute and this guy, Peter, said, hey, you're a bit like my friend Hamish. You should meet him. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah, cool. Where is he? He's like, oh, he doesn't live here. He lives in Sydney. I was like, that's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. But thank you very much for your time. And then, the next March, Hamish moved back from Sydney to uni and this guy, Pete, came up to me and said, hey, this is the guy I was telling you about.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
I said, glad you did.
And what had you imagined yourself to have done, like career-wise, once studying commerce? Like, where were you going to go?
I wanted to be an accountant originally.
Oh, Lord. Didn't you go on a different path?
So I did university accounting when I was still at school. So, I quite liked it, quite good at it. And then I worked at the Good Guys. Do you know the electrical company?
Yeah, I know the Good Guys.
I worked at them over summer in between year 12 and university, and I cancelled $80 million worth of checks instead of presenting them. It was my fault. Obviously, I was pressing cancel, but the lady who taught me how to do it had taught me incorrectly. So it wasn't great for her, wasn't great for me. And back then, it wasn't daily backup. They would back up the system once a week. So everyone's work in the entire office had to be reset to Sunday, and they only found out on Wednesday evening. So it was three days work for everybody that they had to do again.
Wow.
And I went in on the Thursday and I could see everybody not really that thrilled with the work experience guy that had caused them to have to stay back, till 9 o'clock both nights. And so I rang the university, changed all my subjects. I quit and then changed all my subjects there to marketing. So I probably would have gone down that path. Marketing, advertising, potentially. I didn't really know. I didn't really care. Just was happy just to float through.
And was there any idea about comedy or like TV or acting or anything like that?
I was always like mucking about with that stuff, filming stuff with my mates. But it was only really when I met Hamish and we were making each other laugh so much that I was like, oh, this feels special. We should do something about it.
Yes.
So he was doing much harder subjects than me and he had to go to uni more. So every time I was convincing him to skip and we were writing little bits and pieces, I think it was doing more damage to his career than it was going to be to my university career. So I'm glad it came off.
And with any duos, you know, especially at the start, you're both obviously finding your feet. You both have your different voices. Mm. How did you guys get such beautiful synergy between the two of you? Because obviously, you know, it's a new thing for the both of you. Mm. How did you know when one needs to take a certain role and the other one needs to kind of sit back a bit, which you do have now between the both of you?
I think it evolves. I mean, I think through sheer luck, we were mates first and we were mucking around as mates and we were just doing that. And it was working. So we didn't have to be too reflective and work out roles, et cetera. I'm sure that individually you're kind of trying to work out what you want to do.
Yeah.
But I think both of us came to a place where it's like, oh, I think I know how to make the two of us shine better. It was it's interesting in that regard. You kind of sit there and just when more and more, I suppose there's different levels of pressure, people say. And when the show got big really quickly on when it moved to drive time.
Yes.
And that was the first time, in the second year of that was the first time I think we probably felt pressure because there was a lot of money getting made from the show. And that was the reason for the money was ideas. People were seeming to like the ideas. And we never really think that far in advance with ideas. So the station's going to us, hey, what are you doing this year? We're really looking forward to it and we want to sell around it. And we're like, oh, we don't know. We'll see. And they're like, what do you mean you don't know? And we say, oh, we'll see what comes up because we love just being in the moment.
Yes.
And they didn't really like that. Which I can understand because they need to be able to commercialize it. And then that was the first time they were pressuring us to have ideas and it was the first time I were getting asked for ideas rather than just letting them come. And I think, you know, from my recollection of it anyway, Hamish and I kind of banding together in that part to go, all right, this feels a bit weird. How are you feeling? Let's check in with each other. But let's stick by our guns here because we know we'll put together something bad or something we don't like. I mean, whether our ideas are good or bad, people can judge.
Yeah, of course.
But we always like them. So the ones we do anyway. So the worst is doing something you don't like, having to perform something you don't like.
Yeah.
And again, when you talk about learning from the mistakes or how you felt when things weren't going well, it's good to remind ourselves like, okay, that didn't feel great doing that. So let's never do that again. Or let's explore why. Oh, we're going to probably be more passionate about the ideas that we like and then we'll probably perform them better. So let's try and like everything we're doing. It was a good chance, again, for us to cement our space together. Again, because we were mates beforehand, it was always us against the world.
Yeah.
There was never, ever going to be. I think with other duos that get put together, you might be sitting there going, all right, well, I'll make sure mine stuff's good or I might get the next opportunity after this if I perform well here.
Yes, there's always that kind of competitiveness.
There could be.
Yeah.
And so we were lucky not to have that.
What's the biggest disagreement you and Hamish have had?
Look, Not big ones. And not in recent times, no big ones at all because we realized how lucky we were. So I think maybe like I would say decades ago when we were trying to work out the direction of what we might do and you get offered shows.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, should we or shouldn't we take this? There may have been times where one of us wanted to do something that the other might not want to do. And we always came to the spot where unless both of us want to do it, there's no point anyway.
Yeah.
we have the same philosophy with ideas. Like, I might think something's hilarious and the best, and if I'm sitting there trying to convince Hamish it is, and I could see him not quite getting it, he'll always try really hard to get it, I'll go, oh, well, I'll just let this go because we'll have other ones.
Yes.
And that's been our mindset from the get-go. And so, yeah, with disagreements now, I mean, they don't really exist because we're so lucky that you go, why the hell would we bother arguing over anything?
Yeah. Well, I can vouch for working with you for 2 years and never seeing you have a disagreement.
No. I mean...
Or never even coming close, to be honest with you.
No. Because if one of us doesn't want to do something, you just go, all right, well, there's other ways.
Yeah.
And I'm never super passionate about doing... I'm passionate about having fun with my mate, and I think Hame's the same.
Yes.
So if that's the goal, there's no real disagreements that can pop up because none of that's going to be fun. If I argue my way into doing something, it's like, well, we're not going to have fun doing this anyway.
Has there ever been like a competitiveness between the two of you for anything? Or, you know, Hame going now to go and do Lego, which is obviously something separate that he's doing himself and you've done your own things. Has that ever arisen even in the early days?
I reckon in the early days it would be more, again, while you're working at your own space in the world and also in the industry, I think that there would be, you know, I'd be lying to say that that doesn't creep in, but not now. I mean, Lego, for instance, you know, Hame talked to me more about that than anyone later. And I do the same with him. If I'm thinking of doing something, your gen, for instance, coming up, I want to get his take. He knows me well. He knows my strengths well. So we both know the industry really well. So why would I not use that resource?
Yes.
And like I said, we're only ever wanting everyone to... If we're happy, our shows are going to be out. The joint shows are going to be better. So if one of us wants to do something else... And it doesn't even have to be just on screen, even outside of it. If I want to go play golf every Friday, so we never record Fridays ever, Hame will go, yeah, sure, whatever it is, because we know that'll make us happy and we can be succeed here. So we feel that with each other's projects at the moment and go, I mean, I was just thrilled for him, thrilled that it went well. I mean, he would admit it as well. It's like, well, will a show about Lego work? You're like, well, I was saying, well, they're really lucky to have you because I think it's, you know, you'll be able to bring another quirk to a reality type show, which he has, which makes it different in its own. And then, you know, and they put together an amazing show as well. So, it's just good for both of us. Mm. And if the show didn't go well, that's fine as well because it doesn't tarnish anything Hamish and I do together. And I think maybe in the past, we would have worried more about that to go, oh, well, if one of us went across and did something that was not great, how does that affect the duo when it's fledgling, when it's on its way up? But now everybody knows exactly what Hamish and Andy is. Mm-hmm. So anything I do is not going to affect, if I do something that bombs, it's not going to affect the Hamish and Andy brand at all because people can still tune in and get that, yeah.
Obviously, you know, when you're in the public eye, people comment about different bits and pieces. And one thing that has come up here and there, which I personally don't think is true, is that Hamish is the funny one of the duo, you know. How, especially in the early days, did that affect you?
I think he's funny as well. I also think he's funnier than me. So the difference is saying... Is Hamish the funnier one? I would agree. Is he the only funny one? No. Mm. It didn't really bother me. There might be a day where you get a pang, like, I would have loved to have said a punchline there, but I just didn't. We don't write. We don't have writers. We don't write anything.
No.
So it's not like
I have to tell so many people that they're not sitting there with like words in front of them. It's completely
off
the top of the head.
If we had writers, for instance, and someone was handing jokes to Hamish, handing jokes to me, that would feel really different for that dynamic. Anyway. But it's the team, the duo itself. Is what makes and the fact that nothing's written is what makes what it is. And I just want a laugh for the team, whether it's a laugh for Hamish, a laugh for the team, laugh for me, it's a laugh for the team. So it's all bundled into one for me.
Yeah.
It doesn't worry me at all.
What a lot of people I don't think realise is you're the real business brains and complete organisation behind the Hamish and Andy duo. Like, I obviously am in touch with you many times during the week. There's not any, you do not miss a beat with anything, which is absolutely unbelievable. You're so meticulous with everything that happens. And, you know, the a funny story that I laugh about with one of our audio producers is when we had obviously something that we wanted to do for the podcast, and we were back and forth with legal a bit, and then we ended up having a meeting and watching the way that you conducted yourself with Hamish as well, where we had the, you know, the biggest legal team there, and we walked out and me and the audio producer said to each other, we're like, Hamish and Andy just outsmarted the lawyers. Unbelievable. They just ran rings around the lawyers.
No, I don't think we outsmarted the lawyers. No,
it's the way that you chat to people and talk to them and talk them through an idea that everything always works. Everything always works. And I said that to you a while ago. My mantra for working on the Hamish and Andy podcast is everything will always be fine with Hamish and Andy, as in, like, everything will always work out, and everything we do always works out.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the definition of workout is the thing to tap into here, because if something goes hilariously wrong, that has also worked out for us as the show. So that's what's great about it, is that Haim and I don't choose outcomes. You know this.
Yes, no, I do.
And it really shocks producers and also our television producers. So we don't want to know the outcome of anything. We like to find the playground at which to play in. And that gets you in trouble. And then someone might go, you've crossed the line here, 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 here. And we go, okay, well, what language do we need to use to get out of this bind? And that's fun, though. That's fun to talk about. It's fun to talk about that we're in trouble for this and we apologize. Because all of it makes sense in the context of it's so real what we're doing. We're not falsifying anything. So you're able to talk about any outcome. So anything is going to work out.
Yeah.
That makes sense. It's like when there's no path, the end will be the end. So we don't sit there judging, going, "Oh, we didn't end up here, and we said we're going to," because we never said we're going to end up in a specific spot.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that's why things would appear to work out, but it certainly didn't go. It certainly doesn't go the way I thought it might very often at all. But yeah, I think the other thing is, I think that when it's good spirited, when what we're trying to do is good spirited the whole time. And you find yourself in legal arguments, I'm confident that pressing the boundaries there will be fine, because the law is meant to be set up to allow people to have fun and not hurt anyone and not steal from anyone, all these things. And if we're not, you know, troubling anyone, making any money off anyone, breaching any of these copyrights, all these things, and someone's telling us we shouldn't do this, I'm happy to challenge that.
Yes.
Because...
And you challenge most things, which I think is unbelievable. And I've learned so much through it. I'm like, you don't just take anything off face value. You question to get the best outcome.
Yeah.
Where did you start doing that? Like, I think that's a beautiful way of being.
From the beginning. Like, I don't like no's. I don't like anyone saying, no, we can't do that. I don't mind, we can't do that version of that.
Yes.
You know, so like, okay, well, we'll think of a new version of that. So when someone's giving me a no, I want to explore the exact reasons why the no. And if it turns out it's one or two things, all we have to do is address those points and then we're away again. Where often people see a hard no and go, okay, they said no, so that's it. It's, you know, I've got a great example for you. It was we're in New York for Gap Year, first season of our travel show, and Chris Martin and Coldplay were on. We had a challenge for Chris Martin where they have these T-shirt cannons at the basketball matches. We hadn't seen them before. They're out here now, but hadn't seen them before, where they've had these high-powered cannons and they fire T-shirts up to the top rows of the stadiums, right? And so we went and bought one of the T-shirt cannons and we were challenging Chris Martin to fire from outside across the street, fire one through the window of our studio. And if he got it through, we would wear the a promo t-shirt for Coldplay. So Chris Martin's said, his manager said, he doesn't want to do it. And we're like, why? Why doesn't he just get to sit outside? And he's like, no, Chris doesn't want to do it. Okay, no problem. And then they come out and said, oh, look, and one of the other band members will do it. And I was like, right. So I thought, I'll just ask Chris. So Hamish and I were just like, well, today, Chris, we heard that you don't want to do the thing. That's totally fine. Just wondering why.
Yeah,
great. And he said, well, is it possible if one of the other band members do it? And I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, obviously, Chris Martin and Coldplay, people know Chris Martin more than the other guys, but if it's in the interest of spreading it around and heroing Johnny or something, of course, we'd do that. And he said, oh, no, it's just that I've got really sensitive ears. And when this gun goes off, it's going to make a bang and I'm worried for my ears and I've got to perform. I'm like, oh, right. Well, do you mind if we put earmuffs on you?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, yeah, but I don't want to look like a doofus just wearing earmuffs. I was like, well, that's perfectly legitimate as well. And so then we said, well, what if we put a producer next to you wearing earmuffs and someone else in the background who's also wearing earmuffs to make it look like he's really loud and we can pan around and show the cameraman also wearing earmuffs. That'd be great. That'd give me a level of comfort. Now, that's a testament to Chris Martin because he could easily tell his minder, it's a flat no, tell him to work it out. But he was comfortable having the conversation, which shows comfort in his own skin and also a willingness to make things work, which I just thought was just amazing and fabulous. And we had that discussion and it turned out it was something I could never have predicted that it was because of his ears.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, but it was a great bit. He's outside, manages to get through the window. We're wearing his promotional t-shirts for the rest of the show. They're getting much better promotion for it. And then they perform brilliantly at the end. And you go, okay, well, everyone won because A, he was willing to answer the questions, but we were also willing to just inquire as to what is exactly the reason why he doesn't want to do this.
Yeah.
And often if it was something, you know, really clear, we go, oh, we won't press it. But if there's a solution.
Yeah, why wouldn't you go down that way? And you and Hamish obviously did drive for a long time and you became the most successful drive show in Australian history to date. When was the moment that you were like, I think I'm a celebrity now?
Oh, yeah.
I've always wondered when people kind of think that. Like, yep, it's now.
I know. In a way, we still don't, at times. Like, because of the style of radio and podcast we're doing, We share so much of our lives and we expect so much of our listeners to share as well. So our interactions with people in the street are often about them or they're listening to something or they wrote in about this or they're on the show for this. And so it feels more like mates catching up. You don't get that. It's a different feeling for TV. We noticed when we first were on TV, people would come up and they treat you a bit differently.
Like how?
They're just more keen to have a photo and all that kind of things. Yes. That was a really different thing for us.
They kind of hold you like above them to an extent.
Yeah, where radio didn't have that effect really.
Yeah, that's interesting.
We really felt it when we got back from the US after doing the first season of Gap Year. We'd had other shows that were one-offs, but to do our first full season of TV, to live overseas and have not really anyone coming up to you, and then come back and we're like, oh, wow, people watch this, you know, oh, yeah, and that was probably the first time that I felt, oh wow, this feels different.
Yeah.
And Haim and I kind of had a chat about it because I'm feeling the same. We had that control where we were as far as the scientific control, we're over in the US and no one was coming up to us and then come back here and it felt really different at the time.
And so how did you kind of cope with that? Or did you do anything differently? Nah. Like do you walk down the street always wearing sunglasses? Nah. Like, you know, because I know a lot of people who are in the public light do stuff like that.
I know. I just think that's, some people don't like being bothered.
Yeah.
I don't mind it at all when someone comes up. So that's the difference.
Yes.
I don't think there is, personally, I don't think there's a person in Australian television radio, unless you're a Hollywood star, that needs to go and do that. at all. Like, now other people might challenge that.
Yeah.
But I just don't think it's the case.
Like, I tend to agree.
I don't think that we're in awe of any of our Australian television stars, radio stars. We know what they are. We like them, but we're not awestruck by them. The same way as you get awestruck by someone on the big screen.
Mm.
So I reckon that becomes a choice for people. They choose to hide away, and that's fine. Often I think when you choose to hide away, you get more people, you develop more people's interest in you and trying to snap you, etc., paparazzi-wise. But, we just chat to everyone as if they're listeners or friends or whatever it is.
And obviously being in the public eye and the spotlight, that means that, you know, the relationships that you have are going to be in the spotlight as well. How have you, you know, you're a pretty down-to-earth person. How have you dealt with that? And especially having breakups in the public arena.
Yeah, I mean, breakups are really terrible for anyone. So I don't think it's, I don't think it's necessarily more hard for me because they're writing about it. I mean, it puts pressure on new relationships. In the past, I've tried to keep my new relationships secret for as long as possible, and there's a point where it gets out. You never want that pressure in the very beginning of any relationship. You're kind of just sorting out whether you like each other or not, and then it's in Woman's Day. That can be feel a bit more pressure on the situation.
But how do you deal with when they do write things that are completely not true?
It's fine for me. But if people read these things and think they're true, family members think they're true, partners think they're true, and so that's difficult. I don't mind reading something that's fake. So I'm like, who cares? I can't control it, so I'm not going to worry about it. When it affects my family members or my partner, I get a little bit more disappointed with it. But again, I can't fix it. It's about working harder on that relationship with your family member or your partner to make sure that they don't buy into that. But with the human brain's kind of strange that way. We see something written down, it's going to sit in your subconscious. You question
it. Yeah, well, that's it.
And that's a shame. So you've got to work really much harder to strengthen the relationship.
How, being in the public eye, have you been able to keep your confidence and not care what people write about you and not kind of listen to what people say when they do say negative things or write negative things?
Great question. I think I'm lucky because I'm with Haim. So, like, I kind of do the show for him and vice versa. So, when the weight of expectations of whether he liked it, he liked my performance, we enjoyed ourselves, like, that's the measure. I go, well, cool. That actually is the legitimate measure. I'm not trying to progress our careers to be the biggest or best or anything. If we were going down that path, you'd worry about more of those things. We got into it as mates. There's a different reason why we're performing.
Mm.
And not to say, like, I certainly don't think that if people have aspirations to be the biggest, the best and stuff, I'm in awe of those people as well. I don't think that's shallow. I think anyone's allowed to have their own ambitions and I'm an ambitious person, but the reasons for it change changes over time as well. And can be different. But, when it's not the measure, it's like, I don't need anyone to love this other than Hamish, myself, and Tim and Ryan, who I work with.
Yes.
For me to be satisfied with it. And at the end of it, I go, oh, that was really good. Or I'm really happy with how it is. I'm happy for it to go out there and to see how it goes. You can be disappointed if it doesn't go well, but you're never disappointed with. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm embarrassed to show someone something.
No.
And I don't think I've put too much. We have maybe back in the day a few things, but there's not too much in recent times where I go, don't bother watching that.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing to be able to say.
Mm.
You and Hamish run a beautiful team. You're authentic, you're genuine, you are kind, and you're very polite. And it's unbelievable. It's truly, truly, like, you know, to work with a duo and especially, you know, yourself, to have that, to have someone who has those qualities is a really, truly special thing. And I feel it's because, you know, you and Hamish as the leaders, that trickles down and makes for a beautiful team. You know, we all get along so well. Mm. Everything just works so coherently. It's a great place to be. And a lot of people, you know, don't, they're like, really? They're, you know, they think that people who are really famous aren't that nice, but you are truly a beautiful human. Where do you think you got all of those qualities from, and how have you maintained that for fame not to have gone to your head?
I mean, you're saying it's a special thing, and I just wonder why it has to be.
That's a completely good point.
Particularly in this industry and in TV and stuff, there's a lot of people that yell and scream and feel they've got a right to treat people differently because of where they're at or their names on the poster or whatever. And we've just never subscribed to that. There are certain times where, sure, there's, I mean, I think that's historical. And a power imbalance is historical across all workplaces.
Yes.
It's all hierarchical. And it's up to the person at the top of that perceived hierarchy to set the tone. A lot of them may have been treated poorly on the way up, and they get taught that that's the way to behave when you're at the head of a company or doing these things. And I think that can be tricky. But I'm shocked with the way some people choose to behave, because they can get away with it.
Yeah.
Someone said that it's that celebrity doesn't change you; it just makes you 10 times the person. All that attribute just amplifies everything by 10 times. So I think if you're kind, you're 10 times kinder because it's all out there. You have to go to the extra effort.
Yes.
And there's plenty of people that are in that boat. I think for him and for me, it's the same with our families. Really loving parents, great people around. But just speaking to mine, you know, mum and dad, these are things you were taught. And for our particular show, the environment, because nothing's written down and it's all ad lib, the environment is hugely important to us. So people might go, oh, well, that's really nice of them. It's like, it's also self-serving because we need this environment to be heaps of fun because we know we'll perform better in those situations. So why not make sure everyone's having fun the whole way through, because then more ideas are coming in. People are happy to throw up more ideas. People go the extra mile when something silly is going on.
Yes.
So it is self-serving, but it's not the reason we do it.
You treat everyone equally, which I think is absolutely amazing. You know, from the general manager of Oz Stereo to the cleaner to a junior producer on the team, everyone is completely equal to you. Mm. Have you always done that in life?
Yeah, I don't like hierarchy.
Yeah.
You've probably seen that before.
Yes.
And it's not like I'm like against the man, let's bring him down. It's more just, again, there's people in really powerful positions that I've met along the way that share the same values and I respect them so much and the way they lead, and you take a lot from that. But anyone that's going to use their power and their position of power as an extra means to get what they want, I have a visceral reaction to that. So I'm very comfortable treating them just the same as anyone else and making them very aware that I don't care for whether that's a good thing or a bad thing for my future career prospects. But Hayman, I also just want to work with good people.
Yeah.
So there's times where, I've been challenged by people that may have been wanting to impress or may have been a great commercial opportunity. If they are dicks, it's like, oh, well, this isn't for us because it's not going to be long-lasting. We can't have that.
And giving back is a big thing for you as well that I've seen. You know, you do a lot, you're involved in a lot of charity work and, you know, you mentor a lot of people. And even when I started doing this podcast, I remember telling you about it and then you went and listened to a couple of episodes and I was like on the phone to you for like 45 minutes and you were giving me your feedback, which was like, I felt so honored that you had done that and what a beautiful thing to do. How do you, what kind of drives you to do that kind of stuff? You don't need to do it.
I've just got time. I don't have kids. I would say when we started out, If people really want to work and really want to improve, like we did, I was just so grateful for anyone who would lend an ear and lend their advice.
Yes.
So I won't do it unsolicited, but if someone needs that and they're going to act upon it, I'm more than happy to have a listen and give my feedback. And I always temper it like I did with you. It's just like, this is just one person's opinion.
Yeah.
And there's times where there's certain things that have come to me and kids have said, hey, can you look at this? And I don't get it. And I never go, I don't think it's funny.
Yeah.
I just go, well, to my taste, this is stuff, but you might want to think about these bits and pieces. Or I reckon one of my other mates who is in the industry who's doing really well, this would appeal to him. He'd be better to give you advice because I don't have advice on all certain situations.
What I want everyone to know is that, as I was mentioning about the authenticity before, is the podcast you guys do because you truly are doing it to give back and because it is such a beautiful thing, you know. Yeah, it's amazing that it happens to be doing so unbelievably well, but it is about giving back to the community. And the other day you actually put on our WhatsApp chat that we all have, there was a message from a girl who, you know, had her own struggles and is obviously, you know, had different things that she was going through in life, and she had written how much the Hamish and Andy podcast has helped her in her journey to recovery, and without that she doesn't know what she would do, and thank you so much. And you said, you know, you wrote, I'm so proud of our podcast. This is to the whole team. Just saw this post and felt the need to pass it on to the amazing team. This is why we all do this. It's such a beautiful thing because a lot of people wouldn't even care about that. It's just the numbers for them. How many downloads do we get per week? But really, like, you really do care about what an effect in such a beautiful way you are having on other people.
Yeah. Yep. I think Hayme and I love that. We do the show not for that. I'll make that clear as well. We do the show because we bloody love doing it, and there's also commercial benefits, all that kind of stuff. But what I absolutely love that we help people in that way, if we can. And it's my favourite emails to read, and sometimes people post things. The difference is that we get all the accolades. Hamish, like having our names on the poster, we get all the accolades, and it's not two people. It's so many more, as you're aware, in the work that you do, and all the people behind the scenes on television. And so I get to read those because people post them to me, and I feel great about them.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, this is probably a bit unfair that I get to get all this because that story from her or any others should be shared with the team. Jezza, our web geezer, he's such a lovely soul, as you know.
Yes, he is beautiful.
And he, a few years back, and I don't think he'd mind me saying this, he wanted to leave. He was like, I love what I do here, but I'm unsure whether it has purpose and the greater good in the world. And he's got a huge social conscience, and he's brilliant at what he does. And he wanted to maybe put his efforts into something that was helping the world more. And I said, I totally respect that. And I think, and whatever you need, we will support. But I'll, just so you know, I think we are. I think this does. Mm. And it may not be as clear as saying, I'm now going to just do content for ridding the seas of plastic or the oceans of plastic. But I think it does. And I think it's got the ability to hit more people than those bespoke kind of charitable or human rights type thing. So I just said in the weeks after Hamish and I read all our emails, as we try to as CEO, and there's a lot coming in, so sometimes we can't get to them. But I just flicked him a couple of emails, and one was someone with cancer, one was someone who lost their mum, and another person that was going through a really dark time on their own, and how important the weekly show was to them to be able to have a laugh or to help them through this moment.
Yeah, I read hundreds of those emails.
And so I just sent them to Jeremy to go, hey, again, we totally support your decision, and this is not me trying to manipulate you to stay, because I definitely want you to stay, that you know that's clear. But if your search is for something more, I think it could be here, and we can look other ways to, and you not stopping you doing other stuff
yes.
outside. We're not exclusive to us, but you know, you may get that here. And yeah, and he was like, yeah, I think you're right. Like, and that was nice.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So I that's why I love sharing with them
yes.
These type of things with the team, that is, because it deserves equal credit across everybody.
If you could turn back time and go back to your 20-year-old self, what would you say to that 20-year-old?
Get a hair, different haircut. look, there's nothing, I think there isn't really too much hindsight stuff that I reflect on.
Yeah.
Because because I had Haim there the entire time we question stuff together all the time. And so that's the benefit of a tight duo, is that you're constantly getting checked.
Yes.
When I got too big for my boots, Haim would go to me, hey, mate, you want to pull it in? And then I'll go, yeah, you're spot on, you know. So that's really lucky that you feel like you've got a mirror that's actually talking back yeah. at you for the entire trip. So there are certain moments that that I know that I can rely on Hamish for that, and I'm so grateful for that over the run. But as far as, I mean, it would probably just keep doing what you're doing. When you said that everything works out, I honestly believe everything works out.
It does.
Anyway, in life.
Yeah.
Everything will work out if you stay positive. And you don't have to just keep grinding it so you don't like, but stepping back and going, all right, what elements of this am I truly not happy with? I'm going to change that. And people feel they need drastic changes,
yes.
wholesale changes, where it can be really tiny things that can change your framework. Going to bed a bit earlier might be enough for you to change the whole way you're feeling about something. Where you're sitting in an office might change the entire your entire experience there.
Yeah.
I don't like being around this person. Or all these things, you can make tiny changes, but I think just keep doing what you're doing.
What are you most grateful for?
Family, yeah. I think that would be the main one. And then I'm super grateful that Pete was in the quantitative methods tutorial.
Seriously.
Because yeah, I mean, I'm hugely grateful for Haim, and not in a soppy way, only because it's led us to be able to have the best fun in what we do as a job, and you spend so many hours in your job. So to think that this is actually a job, and it's been, well, nearly 20 years since we met. I think 20th year this year since
Haim
and I met.
It's incredible.
And it started pretty quickly. So, yeah, certainly grateful for that.
What is a life of greatness to you?
I think people doing what they want. I am big on people doing exactly what they want and not being judged for it if it's not going to hurt anyone else.
Andy Lee, thank you for being such a beautiful soul and bringing so many laughs to so many millions of people around the world. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ian.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my ebook, Finding Greatness, head to sarahgrimberg.com. And if you love what you heard, then we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. A Life of Greatness's executive producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Audio producers, Matt Nikolic and Darcy Thompson. Special thanks to Grant Tothill for bringing this dream to life. For more episodes, search A Life of Greatness podcast, download the new listener app now and listen for free.
Listener.